welcome to Parle, the Hindu's weekly podcast. I'm Jagriti Chandra, your host for today. During the recently concluded parliament session, the government introduced a bill to raise the minimum age of marriage for women from 18 to 21 years and make it the same as the minimum age of marriage for men. The bill is called the Prohibition of Child Marriages Amendment Bill 2021. After opposition MPs demanded greater scrutiny, the bill was sent to the Standing Committee. The government says that the proposed law will ensure women have an equal chance at higher education and accessing jobs. The government also aims to reduce maternal mortality rate and improve nutrition indicators of mothers as well as children born to them. Will the proposed bill help achieve these goals? Joining me are Mary E. John, former professor and acting director at Center for Women's Development Studies, and Noorjahan Safia Niaz, who's the co-founder of Bharatiya Muslim Mahila Andolan. Mary, let me start with you. Do you welcome the move to raise the age of marriage for women to 21 in order to make it equal to the age of marriage for men?
Hello, and thank you for having me on this podcast of The Hindu. I think we need to maintain a distinction between the act of raising the age of marriage and the question of equality, making it equal to that of men. There has been historically an age difference between men and women's ages at marriage, which might be considered something like a patriarchal construction of gender hierarchy in marriage. This is historically been very widespread. You know, in England, there was an age of 12 and 14 for girls and boys till well into the 19th century. In India, the Sharda Act was 14 and 18, and in 1978, it was made 18 and 21. So the point I'm making here is that there is one issue about what would be a minimum, and it's very important, I think, to emphasize this question of minimum, because there's a lot of confusion here. Minimum age at marriage for anyone, which I believe could well be the same as the age of majority for anyone, which would be 18. This is also the age below which, you know, international conventions of the child have defined a child as someone below the age of 18. So a minimum age at marriage for girls is 18 is fine. It could, in fact, if the question of equality is so critical now, then the age of marriage for boys should also be 18. This would make for, you know, that kind of parity. It would coincide with age of majority. It would coincide with, the way it is in most parts of the world. So I think we really need to put focus on what would be the minimum age, not the right age. I when I look at the existing literature, as well as especially on the government's pronunciations, the constant talk is right age at marriage, age at marriage. There's almost never been the reference to a minimum. The law should prescribe a minimum. I think 18 is as good as any. And the idea here is that don't go below this age of 18, because below that, we run into definitions of, I'm sorry, there are sounds of the barking. Below that is the idea of a child, the idea of harms that may be done because of reproductive and other physical questions of maturity. So there one can have a debate, what would be below 18. I think from 18 onwards, let us consider that to be the minimum age. It should continue to be a legal presumption. And there is no reason, therefore, to raise it to 21.
Okay. Noorjahan, what is your take on this?
Yeah. So Jagruti, thank you so much for getting me here. What I would like to suggest or talk about this issue here is that it is not so much about the equality of marriage between men and women, 18 or 21. The main concern of this law is to raise the girl's age of marriage to 21. And that's where all the challenges are, and how it is going to be impacting women or impacting women at all. So, what I have to suggest here is that the law shows the way to the society, right? So when 18 also came in, probably there was some resentment to that. So whenever there's a law that comes in, which is a little ahead of its time, there is going to be a set of people who will not like it. But the job of the law is also to show the way, to show the trajectory, to show where we are moving as a society. And the law, if I can understand or if I know law, is always ahead of its time. It will never be on par, or it should never be on par with where the society is already. So the problem is not so much the fact that it is going to be raised at 21. The problem is whether the law is requiring the age of marriage to be 18 or 21. The effective implementation of the law is a problem. And not just this law, but any other law that we have in our country. We have wonderful laws. But the implementation is a big, big factor. And unless that improves, we are going to have problems with either the law remains at 18 for marriage for girls, or it turns to 21.
Okay, Nurja, you're calling this as something that's ahead of its time. Can you please elaborate on that?
See, not just this law, all laws, no? So when there's a problem within the society, and when there's no law to address it, and when there's something that comes in, it is ahead of its time. So maybe the argument that is given for the law of age of marriage right now, which is 18, a lot of people think that it's even that law is not really properly implemented. Then what is the need for having it at 21? But if you look at the society, especially urban metro cities, especially a part of our society where girls are educating themselves and they are moving ahead into colleges and universities, that is one section of society that has actually moved ahead. And that section of society also needs a certain protection within the law.
Mary, would you like to come in? And what do you have to say about some of the points that Nurja is making here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue of implementation is a widespread one. I'm not so sure about how we would think about it in this particular context, insofar as, let me put it this way. What are the facts before us, actually? The age at marriage has been steadily increased, the mean age at marriage in India has been steadily, slowly creeping upwards. The proportion of those who are marrying below 18 has been similarly going down, especially in the last decade or so. So if you look at existing data sets as of 2005-06 NFHS data, it was as much as 46% were marrying below in the age group of 20 to 24 years were marrying below the age of 18. That number as of 15-16 was down to 26.8% and is now this NFHS 5 is not very final yet. It's not complete data, but gives us a picture of 23. So we are looking at declines. I think the question of whether something is stopping or not is possibly not a very well-phrased question. We are looking at effective declines. The question is this because of the law or is this because of social and economic forces? As Nur Jahan mentioned, now there are in urban areas a certain class, above the poor classes, are completing high school, are going maybe to college or completing other kinds of degrees. And is this because of the law or is this because the marriage market has developed in such a way that these are the appropriate ages at marriage for an urban middle class? And my tendency is to think that it's the latter, that in fact, it would make no sense for this urban middle class to marry off girls at very, very young ages. That would not work well in terms of their marriage markets, in terms of the appropriate age of the groom, his level of education, what he expects from a wife, and so on and so on. So I don't know if this is going ahead in terms of the questions in your discussion today, but the law, in other words, is playing a purely preventive role. I don't think it's playing a facilitating role. Ages at marriage are moving along as per social and economic processes. Those, I think, will kick in more and more, which is why we're seeing the decline in child marriage and why we're seeing a creeping up in age at marriage. And it will settle down at some place or the other. In India, it may settle wherever. In other countries, it may settle again somewhere else. The minimum is what concerns me. And I think the law is what we're talking about here. And all over the world, the minimum is somewhere between 16 and 18. In some parts of the world, in fact, in the USA, there in some states, you may find this very astounding. There is, in fact, no minimum age at all in their statute books, which I don't support, by the way. These are evangelical, Christian-dominated states where they believe that the Bible hasn't prescribed anything and there's no reason to prescribe it either. But 16, 18, these are commonly, you find these in most parts of the world.
Noorjah, while you welcome the move, you know, there have been some Muslim MPs in Parliament who've called the bill an attack on personal laws because the bill proposes that it will override personal laws of Muslims, Parsis, Hindus and Christians. It also says that some of the personal laws will be amended, though Muslim personal law is not one of them. Do you then not see this as an attempt to encroach on religious laws?
See, encroaching, if you have to really use that word, on personal laws is something which has been happening since, or rather for Muslim community even before independence. So if you look at the laws that were passed for the Muslim community by the British government was way back in 1937 when the Sharia Application Act was passed. Immediately after 2 years, we had the Dissolution of Muslim Marriage Act, which was passed in 1939. Which kind of, in a way, codified the divorce law at that point of time, and it gave the right to Muslim women for divorce. Then if you look at the 86 Act, because we don't have a fully codified laws, hence these piecemeal legislations that have come in. The 1986 Act, which came in after the Shah Bano thing, which is also where the parliament intervened on the demand of these very religious groups who don't want parliamentary intervention now. But they were the ones who actually reached out to the parliament then and asked it to override the Supreme Court judgment which came in favor of Shah Bano. And then we have the triple talaq legislation where again Muslim women demanded an intervention by the state to end this practice. So whether the religious groups reaching out to the government or Muslim women reaching out to the government, it has always happened. So it's not really a new thing. If you look at the Hindu Marriage Act also, which was codified way back in 55, includes the Sikhs, Jains and the Buddhists who are religious minorities. And they are even now governed by the Hindu codified laws. So state has always played that role because state has also recognized the personal laws. It recognizes that each community is to be governed by their personal laws. And if there are problems with the personal laws, then where do we as a citizen go? So that's where the state comes in. The state has to be there to listen to the grievances. If you have to look at the objections raised by the religious groups, if that would be the case, then why did they reach out to the Rajiv Gandhi government in 86? No, they should not have allowed that intervention to happen. So as Muslim women who are also citizens of this country, are we not then expected to have those very constitutional safeguards which all other women of other communities have? Are we not citizens? No. So then that raises a very, very basic constitutional rights of Muslim women. Other than that, a lot of other countries, either Muslim majority or minority, have codified their laws. So Pakistan has codified its law. Bangladesh has. Other countries where Muslims are in minorities, like we are here, they have also codified those laws. So state as an institution has emerged in the last 40, 50, 60 years, and it has played, or in the last century, if you have to say, years that have passed. And state has been playing that role, whether you are a minority or a majority. So I don't think it's an encroachment. If that would be the case, then the Hindus and the Sikhs and the Buddhists and everybody else would also raise this issue of the constitutional safeguards that they are entitled to. And if there's a progressive law that exists in the country, why should I be deprived of it just because I am a Muslim woman?
Okay. You've also said that in the absence of codified law, personal law, this is a positive development for Muslim women. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so see that you have the Hindu, you have four set of legislations for the Hindu community. And when I say Hindu, it includes the Sikhs, Buddhists and the Jains who are otherwise a religious minority. But they are legally, they come within the ambit of the Hindu law. And all other aspects of the personal law, marriage, divorce, custody, no, all those aspects are already codified, as in they are passed by the parliament and they have a statutory status and they are implemented across the country. And not just that, over the period of time, they have also been amended and to make it better. Okay, so that has happened with the Muslim, with the Hindu community. The Christians are governed by their own personal law, their own family law. The Parsis too have their own codified family law. Now, Muslims, because of the kind of politics that played out at the time of partition and the partition itself, and then whatever happened to the Muslim community here, the criminalization and the violence that they faced as a minority, the issue of family law reform always took a backseat. So while the process began in 1937 and 39, where the law began to be codified. And if the partition would not have happened, I'm sure you would have had a codified law probably earlier than the Hindu community. But then partition happened and then we know what happened. But after after we gained independence, there was absolutely no movement towards codifying the Muslim family law. Until 86 happened and Shah Banu went to the court for demanding maintenance. And that too, the legislation that came in actually went against the Supreme Court judgment. So Muslim women again was deprived of the provisions of the CRPC 125. Of course, later on with the Daniel Latifi judgment in 2000, the damage that that law caused was subverted. But the fact remains that this law was an attempt to get the Muslim women out of the ambit of all the legislative protections and the constitutional safeguards. And till date, we don't have a codified family law, which is based on the text, the religious text, because all other personal laws are also based on the religious text. We don't have that. It's so whatever provisions that we want as in a codified law have to be based on the Quran and have to be based on the constitutional safeguards, constitutional values. And we still don't have it. And we are in the 75th year of our independence and 15% of the population of this country. We are second after Indonesia in terms of Muslim population. We are deprived of that legal security, which everybody else is having. And that's the reason why these kind of piecemeal legislations that are happening, whether the triple talaq, triple divorce law came in 2 years back, or now when there's a talk of, in fact, our problem is even 18 was not applicable to us. It's still not. The PCMA and the various judgments that have come in, the Supreme Court judgments and contradictory High Court judgments, where some say that the PCMA applies to the Muslim community and some say that the PCMA doesn't apply to the Muslim community. So our tragedy is that even the 18 as the year of marriage for girl is not fully implemented for the Muslim community.
What is it then the Muslim community is required to follow under the personal law?
Yeah, so it's the Sharia law, which is again not codified. And the Sharia law says that it has to be puberty or age 15. Yeah, so where is the protection even for the 18 years of marriage that everybody else has had it for so many years? So either you fully codify the Muslim family law, bring in all those legislative protections, or if these kind of legislative changes are happening in the law of the land, then they should be made applicable to the Muslims also. And that is why we are insisting that within this amendment of this current bill, where we are talking about 21, a specific special mention has to be made that the Muslim community also should be coming under the ambit of this law. Even if tomorrow 21 is not implemented, even the law as it exists today of the age of marriage being 18, even that should be made applicable to the Muslims. To that extent, that amendment is necessary.
So I'd like to now shift focus from the religious angle and come to the stated purpose of the bill. The bill says that it aims to reduce maternal mortality rate, improve nutrition indicators, as well as ensure access to education and jobs for women. Mary, how will raising the age of marriage help achieve these goals?
Just if you don't mind, I just want to comment. I think Noorjahan has raised a very, very important point in the previous discussion, if I may just add to that. And that is the point she has made about the sharp difference post-partition, the way in which Muslims in our country became a minority, and the fact that this acted as an extreme impediment in terms of other kinds of changes, at least in the legal domain, by a community that felt embattled as a minority and saw everything as an attack on itself. And the comparisons that Noorjahan has made with Pakistan or Bangladesh, which have made changes in their own laws, codified their laws. I think this is a very, very important point and has been the subject of considerable debate, especially in the women's movement. And I just want to note that, that let us take on board the fact that it's not the same kind of question, therefore. This brings me to the point that you have asked just now, Jagriti. And here, actually, another point I want to make is, if you look at the data, then there is no difference between Hindus and Muslims as far as our data sets go. There are the similar proportions of 26.8 in the 15-16 data. That's the latest data that we have. It's a very, in fact, if anything, there's a slightly higher, better picture on the part of the Muslim as far as data sets go compared to the Hindus, which of course is a very large composite group. Muslims have the popular conception is that Muslims are always backward compared to Hindus. Not true here. As far as our underage marriage data goes, the pattern is much the same. I just thought I'd make that point. And the next point that you've asked me now, and this is where I have written a fair amount because it's my area of research. The claims that are being made that the nutritional status of the mother and child, that the degree of maternal mortality rates will all improve with an increase in the age of marriage simply do not hold up. And I was really surprised myself when I saw the data. The point here and the confusion here, there's a tremendous level of confusion because if you simply look at higher ages at marriage, you will look at better data sets. The reason being that higher ages at marriage correspond with better off people, people with better health indicators already, people who are wealthier, marry at later ages. However, if you control for all these factors, you know, if you perform the necessary statistical tasks and you only concentrate on the factor of age alone, then you find that age plays the least significant role in any of these indicators. Anemia is not affected by age at marriage, and anemia is the cause for our terrible maternal mortality rates. An anemic woman, even at the age of 25, forget 21, the same rates will apply to her, the same anemic rates apply to her as to a 21-year-old or an 18-year-old. Nutrition also does not improve. A poorly nourished woman does not become better nourished because she's being married off 3 years later. I think once you internalize that, it makes intuitive sense. So sex ratios is particularly off because actually the worst sex ratios, if you want to know, you know very well where the worst sex ratio states are. They don't are not the worst child marriage states. There are states like Punjab and Haryana, which have very high, comparatively higher than average ages at marriage. Sikh community has the worst sex ratios, as we know very well. They do not have prevalence of child marriage. So there's a lot of confusion here. And the so-called scientific basis that is being put out by the government does not hold up, actually.
Some of these points that Mary has made, Anurja, you also agree with, and you've said this, that just raising the age of marriage to 21, it does not answer all the problems.
Yes, completely. Law is necessary, but definitely it's not sufficient. And law is just one of the various multiple institutions which help a society to grow and develop. It is not the only one. It plays a facilitative role. It shows you the way. It shows you the trajectory. But other than setting up legislations, a lot needs to be done not just other schemes and programs, that is another issue completely, but the effective implementation of that particular law itself is important. So I wonder how the 18, when the law age of marriage is 18, I know how it is difficult for people to access that law, not just this law, but any legislation. The triple talaq legislation came in 19 and is struggling with the police. The first institution where a woman approaches to file a complaint is the police, and they have still not improved. So many reforms, so many police training, so much has happened. So much of work is happening with the police by the NGOs, but they just refuse to perform. So if the implementing agencies, which are state-backed and they are the arms of the state, if they don't implement the very law that they make, then it just doesn't make sense. Secondly, other than the law itself, the various schemes and programs, wonderful on paper. You read them and you feel, my God, they're so good. But on the ground, there's nothing. You try and access just the scholarship scheme, and we as an NGO, we just gave up because it just doesn't happen. It just, things just don't move. So that whole machinery is so complacent, ineffective, apathetic, and doesn't move. So if those things don't happen, how are we going to make this society a better place? How are you going to help the women access the laws that exist? Forget the amendment. The existing laws itself is a difficult proposition for women, especially, to access. Other than that, there is the whole privatization of education and health that has happened over the last 3 decades, where education is out of bounds for the poor and the middle class, and now with COVID, things are even worse. So this whole commercialization of education, if that continues, how are the poor and especially women and girls are going to access education? If health services don't improve, if our districts and villages and smaller towns, if they don't have health facilities, how the hell are women going to be accessing those schemes and programs? So that's a big, big, big gap that we have. So that simultaneously also needs to get activated and become effective. And just to respond to what Mary said in the previous thing, the Muslim community may be better on some of the parameters that we are discussing. But the question is here of legal parity. Why are we not on par with the rest of the citizens? If 18 is the age of marriage for the entire country, why should Muslim women be left behind? If polygamy is something which is not allowed, it governs 494 IPC, governs the Christians and the Parsis also. Why should not 494 be applicable to the Muslims as well? So how long are Muslim women going to be suffering just because we have been told time and again that our minority status is in danger? We are putting ourselves in danger, right? If we have the provision of codifying our laws, we're bringing it on par with in the society that we're living in. When we can bring it on par with bringing in the best of provisions of the Quran, who's stopping us? The state is not stopping us. And if you don't reform, if you don't change, then the state will step in. The part of the community will allow the state to step in if you don't reform it yourself.
Okay. Nurja, you also just spoke about, the implementation gaps, etc. And many have flagged certain concerns with the manner in which the Prohibition of Child Marriage Act 2006 has been implemented and the way it's playing out in the lives of young adults who want to marry against the consent of their parents. Also, these days, in case of interfaith marriages, where a 17-year-old Muslim girl elopes to marry an 18-year-old Hindu boy, and the manner in which the law is misused and targeted, how then can they be protected?
No, see, I understand. These are issues and there are going to be problems. Any law, when it comes into being, it doesn't play out equally for all the sections of the society. We are huge. We are a huge country. We have all kinds of people, different social strata, different economic strata, different diversity in our religions, in our caste composition. It's huge. So when a particular law comes in, it's not going to be playing out uniformly across the entire country. Triple divorce law, it's good for certain section of the society, but not good for others. Domestic violence law that came in, and there were problems. Some sections, especially the men, were not happy with it. So ek samaj ka ek hissa to rahega hi, who will kind of slip out. It will fall off the net. And maybe here is where the court comes in, and here is where the judges who sit and take decisions vis-a-vis a certain case that has come up. It is their vision and their understanding and their understanding of the law that comes in. But yeah, I understand there will be some section which will maybe not benefit from the legislation. But that stands also for 18. So somebody is 15 and wants to have an intercaste or interreligious marriage, and the law really is not, she is not within the ambit of the law. Even they are going to have problem. And we are facing that already. I really don't know how that can be addressed, because finally the case comes up to the police station or state, or the case comes up to the magistrate. And how magistrates give their judgments, how sensitively they handle such cases is up to how the law is stated and how they want to see what is their vision in implementing a legislation.
Mary, your comments on the way the law...
Yes, could I comment here? Yes. Actually, this is a very... Noorjahan has spoken very well about it. This is a very tricky area because... As Nuja has pointed out, the highly selective way in which laws are implemented in our country and the fact that the most well-intentioned organizations find themselves at a loss, what existing studies show, and that is also particularly scary in the current moment, what the existing studies show in terms of implementation of the PCMA by the child protection officers and so on, is one where it is parents of a girl in an so-called elopement, a love marriage that they are opposed to, they are the ones who are bringing the cases to the courts. In other words, this is where it's happening. It's not happening where actually communities and so on are going ahead with underage marriages. It is happening here. That is to say, it is being used by parents to stop and render illegal an existing love marriage that may be happening at the cusp of underage. So please imagine what would happen tomorrow if the age were raised to 21, when in fact the majority of the Indian youth would in fact be caught, and where perhaps chosen marriages may be part of what they would like. And they are young adults. Let's please be very clear. They are not children. By the laws of the land, they're young adults. Young adults will find themselves at cross purposes with this new law, whereby other adults will be able to render their relationships null and void and leave them in a complete legal limbo, if not in a criminalized situation. In the state of, in the country of Nepal, next door, where age at marriage was recently raised to 20 for both men and women, there's a huge crisis looming there. Large numbers of young women are in shelter homes simply because they're in this legal limbo and have nowhere to go. So is this the kind of future we want the law to create for us? Is really a very troubling question for me.
So we have very strong arguments on both sides of the debate, and the standing committee clearly has its task cut out. Thanks a lot, Mary and Noorjahan.